and welcome to Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can jump up and down and shout, "Yes, I'm in." Now, let's start with a few questions. Which school was ranked number one by Points and Quants in a survey of admissions consultants for both getting to know applicants and for being transparent? Tuck. And which program consistently and resoundingly beat out all others in terms of alumni giving? You guessed it, Tuck. And who is the guest on today's show? The woman in charge of the Tuck admissions office. In just a minute, we're going to learn the secret sauce. Actually, not so much a secret because Tuck is so transparent. But we're going to learn about Tuck's MBA program and, most importantly, its admissions process. First, a quick reminder, if you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accept.com/118. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Delighted to engage with you in that way. So please feel free. Again, info.accept.com/118. Also, a reminder, next Wednesday, September 9th, I'm going to be presenting 5 ways to make B-Schools love you. This is aimed primarily for round 2 applicants, although round 1 applicants are more than welcome, round 2, round 3, next year applicants. This is going to be kind of a foundational webinar for the application process. You can just go to the Accepted homepage and you'll see the link, or again, we will link to it in the show notes at info.accepted.com/118. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Donna Clark, Admissions Director at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Donna started her career in MBA admissions at UNC Kenan Flagler while earning her master's in higher ed there. She then served in admissions at Darden the last 5 years as director, which is where I first met Donna. In 2005, Donna took over the directorships of Tuck's MBA admissions office, where she has served ever since. She was a guest many times on Accepted's old online chats, and I'm now delighted to speak with Donna on Admission Straight Talk. Donna, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you so much, Linda. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the people who are taking the time to listen.
Let's start by turning to the application itself, or let's go from the specific to the general. A lot of people wonder whether they should take the GRE or the GMAT. For Tuck, is there a difference? What do you recommend?
There is not a difference. We accept both the GMAT and the GRE, and we find that some students do better on one versus the other. We do not have a preference. We leave that decision up to the applicant, and I generally recommend making that decision based on what test you think you're going to perform better on. Some people might not know that until you actually start studying for the tests. I recommend getting the official guides from each organization, from the Educational Testing Service in the case of the GRE, and I recommend getting the official guide to GMAT review in the case of the GMAT. But if it were me, I would probably explore both exams, maybe take some practice tests in one or the other, and see how you're doing. And if you just don't feel that one is going to be indicative of your ability or a reflection of your quantitative ability or whatever, then you can always turn your attention to trying the other one. But we do accept either score.
Okay, that sounds like great advice.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, this is kind of goes a little bit beyond the scope of your question, is the GMAT has a new service available, and I believe it's called an enhanced score report. So if a candidate takes the GMAT exam and he or she, A, is not happy with their score, you can cancel it on site and you can reinstate it later should you decide to reinstate it. There is a fee for that. But if you cancel a score, you're not happy with your score and you want some diagnostics on what you can do better in your next attempt at the GMAT, there is an enhanced score report service that an applicant can get to give you some feedback on the areas of the GMAT you performed well on and the ones that need some more attention in terms of studying.
That's right. It's a great feature. Just the ability to...
It's really, I think it's great.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, there's a rumor out there we're going to resort to the good old rumor mill here.
Okay.
That consultants, investment bankers, the more traditional MBA applicants, should take the GMAT. The non-traditional liberal arts majors should go more for the GRE. What do you think of that rumor? Is there any basis to it?
I have not heard that rumor, so it's great to be part of the rumor mill. I have not yet heard that.
Now you know where to go.
Yeah, exactly, Linda. I'm going to call you for the latest. I don't believe it reflects how we feel at all. I really think that decision is within the control of the applicant. We accept both scores, and we do not have a preference based on one's background. That's all I can say on that subject.
Okay. We'll leave the rumor mill for then.
Okay, great.
Let's go back to Tuck's application. What is the difference between Tuck's early decision deadline and the other three deadlines? Is it just that the deposit for early decision is accepted applicants is due January 15th as opposed to April 29th for the November and January rounds and June 3rd for the April round? Is there any difference in acceptance rates between the different rounds?
You're right. The response deadline is one of the differences. But one of the things we hear regularly from our faculty members and our members of our community is that we want students who really want to be here at Tuck, that enthusiasm really translates into the classroom and it translates into the extent to which a student is engaged in the community. So the early action deadline is really designed for applicants who know that Tuck is either their first choice or that Tuck is among their top choices. There are multiple ways that an applicant can signal to Tuck that they've really done their research, they know Tuck's program, and early action is one way to signal that an applicant is very serious about the Tuck MBA program and has done a lot of assessment about their background and where they want to go and how Tuck can serve as a bridge in getting there. It is true that we are slightly more generous with acceptance rates in early action. Again, because of the sentiment that we want students who really want to be here. And I would say there is something to be said for the cliche, the early bird gets the worm, in that the early bird is often very organized. I mean, a lot of students who apply early action really demonstrate that they've had their act together, they've been researching. Perhaps they had an opportunity to research schools earlier than some applicants and to take the GMAT or the GRE and to get those essays done and come for an interview. So I find the applications in early action to be very strong, but we are slightly more generous with our offers of admission. The acceptance rate for early action does vary from year to year, and it is dependent on both the size and the quality of the early action round. We are unique, though, in that we do have three other deadlines in addition to early action. We have the November 4th deadline, the January 6th deadline, and the April 4th deadline. And if an applicant is not ready to apply in early action and feels that his or her application would be stronger by submitting it in November or January, that's exactly what they should do. Somebody shouldn't rush and expedite an application in early action when what they need to do is maybe retake a GMAT or GRE or finish a class or finish a project or work. There are very good reasons to apply in November and January as well, and that's why we have four deadlines.
And what about the last one?
We do have an April deadline. It is April 4th. We always admit people in the April deadline. We would never have a deadline and not extend offers of admission to candidates. I would try to avoid applying in April because just as early action enables us to maybe be a little bit more generous, the April deadline, it prohibits us from making as many offers of admission sort of per capita because the class is in large part full at that time, and it's a very competitive round. But again, that being said, some people are just not ready or maybe haven't come to the conclusion that they want to seek a Tuck MBA until a little bit later in the process, and we do always admit students in the April round.
How is the application processed and evaluated? So I hit submit, right? I'm an applicant, and I hit submit.
Right.
What happens?
Okay, so an application is not reviewed until it's completed. So let's assume you hit submit and everything is collated and complete.
And my letters of recommendation are in.
Yes. It's like many people would say, a holistic process, and we're looking at application being complete, meaning we need to have the application itself, the letters of recommendation, the GMAT or the GRE, a transcript. We need to see if a person has interviewed, has the interview report been submitted, and so on and so forth. So we have an extremely thorough process. I'm actually very proud to say how thorough our process is. An application, the typical process is an application is sent out for review by one member of the admissions committee. It is rarely reviewed by the same person who conducted the interview. And that is done so that if somebody has a really strong interview, the person who's reading the application isn't biased by the interview. Likewise, if somebody had a weak interview, it's not fair to the candidate for the same person who interviewed him or her to review the file. The file is typically sent to a second person, a professional reader on the admissions committee. No students are involved in the reading process at TOC. And then I see every file, all 2,600 of them this year.
Wow.
Sort of some, I'm very passionate about compiling the class. But one of the things I'll say, it's not just sort of, in my mind, how the evaluation works, but it's who evaluates them. We have a really seasoned staff. We've had very, very little turnover among our professional readers. And I think this is really important because there's a lot to learn when you're reviewing a file about a lot of industries and the career trajectory. The admissions committee has some people who have a former business background. We have some people who were former attorneys. There are some of us who are sort of seasoned admissions professionals. But one of the things that I'm really proud of with regard to how an application is reviewed is also who is reviewing them and the lack of turnover we've had. I've just got a terrific team whose judgment I think is really good. And then, like I said, I do see every single file and sign off on every single one. This year, we tried something different. For each of the four rounds, we had admissions committee. And in each of the four rounds, the admits were presented in committee. And we did that, again, as part of the calibration process.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody sees every file. So at the end of the round, everybody hears a synopsis of every single candidate to whom we are going to extend an offer of admission. And in addition to those candidates who are presented in committee, we are talking about typically 5 to 10% of the pool in cases that are not as clear-cut. There may be a candidate, for example, who we're really excited about, but we're a little concerned about their quantitative ability and whether this year is the best year for them to come or whether they would benefit from taking some quantitative classes. Or there may be a candidate, again, that we're really excited about for multiple reasons, but maybe a little shy on work experience. So, the gray files are just discussed in committee. So it's very, very thorough, and I'm really excited about the experience and longevity that the members of the admissions committee have at TOC.
I mean, I hadn't thought of it, but just this tremendous continuity on your team. There's no question. I mean, just from, my seeing the same names over and over again for years.
Yeah, we do. We have a lot of continuity, and I think that really benefits the review process because there's such a learning curve with reading about applications and, like I said, learning about everything from candidates from various branches of the military to AmeriCorps to Teach for America to, the various trajectories that occur at investment banks, private equity firms, consulting firms. So I think it's a huge asset to our review process. There is such continuity and such good judgment and such good experience among the people who are reviewing these files.
Great. Now, you mentioned that the gray files, that sometimes you have a candidate and you think this candidate would be great in a year, or this candidate looks great, but I'm worried about the quant skills. Do you ever give that feedback to candidates, whether they're waitlisted, rejected, or kind of in this never-never land where you just say, gee, I wish this person had X?
We do. I think one of the hallmarks of our program is our admissions process.
It's transparency, of course.
Is the transparency and the fact that we do invest a fair amount of time and energy into feedback with candidates. So say there's a candidate who, like many candidates who have many strengths, I think most of the people who apply to TALK have a lot going for them, but maybe there's something that we're concerned about and that candidate, let's just say hypothetically, that candidate ends up on the wait list. We do have a process so that waitlisted candidates can get feedback from a member of the admissions committee. And then there are many students who are denied admission who receive feedback if they are planning to reapply to TALK. I would say on average, this can vary a little bit, but I would say typically about 15% of our applicant pool each year is comprised of reapplicants. And I have numerous examples over the years, many, many examples of someone who applied to TALK in 1 year, got feedback, and presented a more successful application the following year. Not all reapplicants are successful. Sometimes somebody reapplies and they don't take advantage of the feedback call, or sometimes they did take advantage of the feedback call but didn't really heed the advice that we gave them and may submit an application that looks very similar to the one beforehand. But we have many, many people that we work with to help coach and give them some guidance on what they can do to present a more competitive application the following year.
I once spoke to an admissions director who will remain nameless, and okay. His school had had a policy of giving feedback and stopped giving the feedback. And when I asked him why, he said, he basically said that the candidates were taking the school's time and getting the feedback, improving their application, and then going and applying elsewhere. Mm. And so he stopped it because he didn't feel it was paying for his institution,
right,
which on some level makes sense. How do you feel about that?
We try as a team to implement policies that reflect the culture of TALK. Mm-hmm. And TALK is very well known for the small scale accessibility, among other things. It's, you know, a culture of personalization. And I feel that in the admissions process for our school, we need to walk the walk and talk the talk. And sure, there are probably many examples of people who received feedback and may have been successful at another school, but my guess is that they think very positively about TALK, regardless if they reapplied here or went someplace else. So if the outcome is that somebody walks away from that process and they feel that our school provided them with a service that enables them to feel positive about TALK and perhaps speak positively to other students that may be considering TALK, then to me, that's a win. Of course, we love the success stories when we give the feedback and people take that feedback and they reapply. And then many times, you know, we've developed a relationship with sure. these students. It is time consuming, but I think it's a policy that reflects our culture, that we get really good feedback about,
yes,
regardless if somebody reapplies or not. I think it makes a statement about the accessibility that you get at TALK. And, you know, they interact with admissions before they interact with anyone else. So I'm very proud of that policy, and we'll be sticking with it for now anyway. So
sounds good to me. I mean, I know it's tremendously valuable to applicants. I always encourage applicants, if they are considering reapplying to school, to try and get feedback from the school. It's just that fewer and fewer schools are providing that feedback, but it is tremendously
right.
valuable. Whom would you like to meet when you're reviewing an application and a file? I think there's a, this is not a rumor, there's a sense out there that it's the application, but the application is really a representation of the human being who created the application.
Right, sure. Yeah.
So who would you like to meet through that application?
We want to meet as many of them as we can, and that's why we have an open interview policy at TALK. And what that policy means is that anybody who is applying to TALK has the opportunity to interview at
right.
TALK. And we do that because it is difficult to make judgments strictly on the basis of a written application.
Right.
To have that personal interview in addition to the application is really valuable to us. And while that is not required, we want to provide that opportunity to anybody who's applying to TALK. A student does not have to wait to be invited to have an interview. Everybody has that opportunity. So I would say in terms of who we want to meet, we have that policy because we want to meet as many of them as we can.
Right.
So
no, I
know that on a very basic level, you know, there are qualities that equate to success at Talkin in the long term that are just really hard to assess on the basis of a written application. And we try to get to some of those through the letters of recommendation, for example. But what an interview enables us to do is focus on things like oral communication skills and emotional intelligence and maturity and presence and poise and, you know, a little bit in terms of self-awareness. There are usually some questions about the ability to work in teams. And then there's some crossover, you know, with the application ask why a candidate is interested in an MBA in Talkin, and we typically ask that in interviews as well. And I think one of the joys of the job for many of us that gravitate toward admissions at the core of it comes down to meeting the applicants. It's inspiring, but we have the open interview policy because we want to meet as many of them as we can.
That's great. I think this has been a wonderful answer, and I thank you for it. What I was more interested in when talking about meeting the applicant is before you get to the interview stage, when you're reviewing the file, what gets you excited about the file in a positive way?
Right.
You're reviewing the resume, you're reviewing the letters of recommendation, you're reviewing the essays.
What can get us excited? I mean, we could probably answer that in dozens and dozens of ways. And I think about conversations we have just in our hallway or in admissions committee. And it seems like a really easy question, but I think people can shine for different ways in different ways. There was an applicant at a small group event that I hosted last week in Princeton.
Yeah.
And he stood out because his interpersonal skills were so strong. It was a small group meeting. He did such a good job of almost co-hosting the event with me and really drawing out the experience of other people, being aware of not monopolizing the situation, but maybe saying something and saying, what do you think? I mean, his interpersonal skills and his social skills were so impressive. That's how he stood out. I can think of a woman. We have summer visitation days in the summer. So for people who aren't applying this year, but maybe thinking of applying next year, we do have some visitation days. And I can think of a woman that I met last year who's now in our first year class who did a lot of corporate sponsorship ads for Major League Baseball. And it was so interesting to talk to her as a female in a very male-dominated field and sport. Sometimes it could be something that the person has done, like a military mission. It could be a story of hardship and resiliency that a student has overcome. It could be just, you know, they have a certain passion for something or the kind of presence or that sort of lights up a room. There's so many ways to answer that question. But I really think, I really believe that when people get to the point of applying to a top school like Tuck, most of them have a lot going for them and they all can shine in some way. And I guess the exercise that I would recommend doing is just asking themselves, what is it about myself that I most want this committee to know? Or as I'm preparing for an interview, how can I shine? And just, you know, I know it sounds like a cliche, be yourself, be authentic. People say that all the time, but it's so, so true. And sometimes the most simple of skills or talents or traits can shine. It's not necessarily that somebody worked on a multi-billion-dollar project.
Or swam the English Channel.
This guy. Yeah, exactly. Take the example of the guy at the event. It was just how he interacted with other people and drew people out and was so sensitive and self-aware and so gracious. I mean, it's very, very simple, but he stood out to me.
In a really positive way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now that's a great answer. And I think your point about just thinking about what, for an applicant to think about, what do they really want you to know that isn't covered or isn't provided elsewhere in the application? I mean, I think that's a fantastic way to approach specifically the essays.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have specific questions we ask and we have questions in the interview. But, you know, one of the things we usually train our interviews to do and one of the things I do when I'm interviewing, and I encourage our second year interviewers to ask, is there anything else about yourself we haven't talked about that you were hoping to talk about? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great way to repair is just, regardless of what the school asks, and yes, you do want to answer the essay questions and you do want to stay on track in the interview, but what is it that I want them to know about me? And it might not be a thing. It might be just, you know, that they have a vivacious personality or a contagious level of raw energy. It could be something very, very basic, and it can be something very profound.
In terms of personal qualities, whether it's infectious energy or vivaciousness or any of those things, I think those would kind of come through. But what right. I sometimes have applicants, assist applicants do is they write down those events, things, whatever that they're most proud of that they would most like the admissions committee to know about. They also think about what character traits those events are associated with.
Exactly.
And then you also go both ways. So think about right. what character traits they feel are most impressive in them or that they're most proud of, again, and think about events where they've displayed those character traits so they can go either
exactly.
way in an interview
right.
situation.
And to your point, say, you know, you're talking to a candidate, maybe they've been really effective at something, but they were kind of a quiet leader.
Yeah.
So I use the examples of raw energy or, you know, contagious personality or vivaciousness, but not everybody has to be vivacious and
right.
have raw energy. There are people who can be equally impressive in a completely different way and stand out as sort of a very a quiet leader, but and a very effective one. So, oh gosh, I mean, we meet people every day who we get excited about for so many different reasons. That's what keeps it interesting.
That's for sure. No, for both our jobs. Now, let's talk about Tuck, the school, for a moment. We've been focusing very much on the application and the admissions. Tuck is famous for its incredibly passionate alumni who annually mm-hmm. set records for generosity. What is the percentage of alumni that contributed last year to Tuck annual giving?
Okay, so the
I know you love that number.
I do. The alumni participation rate was 70.9% this year, and that is nearly triple the average of peer business schools. We're very proud of that.
Just to give more context to that number, the next closest school has a giving rate in the low 50s. I don't know if it's 51 or 52%, and the third one is in the low 40s.
Yes,
so
that's correct.
That is
Thank
an
you,
absolutely
Linda.
Phenomenal number. Okay.
And you know that the track record that has been the case for
years.
That you know we've had seven. I've been at a rate of 70% for years, and you know to increase it slightly to 70.9%, we're really proud of. But I would also draw prospective students' attention to the symbolism of
that's
that
my next question. Why
figure? Okay. I think it's just such a telling indicator of
yeah.
the alumni, the graduates' commitment to the school. They are just incredibly generous, not only with their money, but equally importantly to us with their time. They're very involved in the admissions process. They're incredibly involved in the career development office. So that's a huge advantage. I mean, as you're looking at schools and thinking about how to tap in to the alumni network, a lot of times people are tapping into that alumni network with regard to their job search, and prospective students may have seen that the Economist ranked Tuck's alumni network number one in effectiveness last year, and it's not the first time we've been ranked number one, but I think the giving rate, I love to talk about the giving rate because of the symbolism of, you know, how invested and how pivotal the experience was for the alumni. That so many of them want to give back to the school, and that's one tangible way to measure it among other. The other thing I would say is that it's very important for Tuck, and with regard to the alumni involvement, Tuck does an amazingly good job of involving alumni boards into various aspects of the school. So, for example, there's a private equity board that works with the Center for Private Equity and Entrepreneurship. There is an overseers board that is the equivalent of the trustees. There's an MBA advisory board. And there are international regional boards, one for Asia, one for Latin America, and one for Europe, that are all made up of very involved alumni who are helping to expand the scale and scope of Tuck internationally.
And that kind of leads to my next question, which is almost in contradiction to the one about the giving. You know, I've been to Tuck. I visited a couple of times. It's absolutely gorgeous, as is the whole Dartmouth campus. However, some applicants may worry that for all the rural beauty, the remoteness of Hanover, New Hampshire could limit the experiential aspects of their MBA education by making consulting projects more difficult or limiting the number of practitioners who'll go up to Hanover, or networking outside off of Tuck, again, could be harder, or even the job search could be harder, or international treks would be more difficult because it's harder to get to the airport. I realize that on some level, the giving statistics that we just discussed, you know, contradict this, but how would you address those concerns?
No, I think that's a really legitimate question, and a question that we've gotten very frequently over the years. What I hear from current students and alumni again and again is that actually Tuck's location is an advantage to students throughout their 2 years. And a large part of that is that the location allows the students the opportunity to really immerse themselves in their MBA experience at Tuck. One of the things you hear about Tuck, and I realize you hear about community at other MBA programs too, but it's particularly pronounced here, the tight-knit bonds that are formed at Tuck, I think are formed because we're not in a major metropolitan area. There's not a city to escape to. We are residential. About 60% of the first-year students live in a residence hall that is they're attached to Tuck, and then the remaining roughly 40% live in off-campus housing, but they're all here on site, really involved not only in their classes and study groups, but in so many extracurricular activities that are available. I also would say to people who are exploring Tuck, if you come to Tuck, you're also part of the greater Dartmouth community. Mm-hmm. Dartmouth is an Ivy League school. It's amazing the opportunities that take place on our campus in terms of the guest speakers. New Hampshire is a primary state, so this is going to be a great year to be a student at Tuck because every single presidential candidate will be on this campus most likely multiple times.
And there's so many of them this time.
I know, exactly. So you could be busy just going to hear the presidential speakers, but you're part of Tuck, which is a very tight-knit community, but you're also part of the greater Dartmouth community. And of course, I'm just in love with New England and New Hampshire and the uniqueness of what's available to do in the area. Whether you're outdoorsy or not, Dartmouth does a great job. They have a canoe and kayak club. We have our own skiway. There's cross-country ski lessons. There's lots of cabins that Dartmouth owns and places to hike. But part of your question, too, about the location is it a disadvantage in terms of the career search process? And we're really pleased that for the class of 2014, 98% of our graduates had job offers 3 months after graduation. That's one of the best statistics in our peer group.
Yes.
100% of the students found internships. There are 900 active recruiting relationships with recruiters. Tuck had the second highest starting salary, including bonuses. One of the things I hear from recruiters, and I used to have lunch with them more frequently when I came, is that so many of them have opportunities to recruit in major metropolitan areas, and it's almost a perk to be here. You get to be in this cute, pristine, charming town in New England is, many people perceive that as a perk. A lot of the people who come to recruit and to do company briefings are Tuck grads, and given what we've been talking about with the enthusiasm of the Tuck alumni, you can imagine how excited they are to come back and recruit at their alma mater. So it is a very good and legitimate question, but I don't think it is a disadvantage. The other thing Tuck has been very, very proactive in doing is creating a new global requirement. It was a requirement last year. It's called GLOW, and it stands for GO, for Global Opportunities. All Tuck students are required to participate in an experiential global experience, and that requirement can be fulfilled by either doing a global first year project. You can participate in a global exchange program, the Global Insight Expedition, or an on-site global consulting project. So while it's wonderful to be immersed here and part of this community, everyone is required to work to fulfill this requirement. And some students do more than one. So I hope that answers your question about the location.
Yeah, I think it answers it superbly. I also want to mention that I interviewed for Admission Straight Talk Dean Stockin in episode 71, and we'll be linking that. You can find that at info.accepted.com/71, and we'll be linking to that show from the show notes, today's show notes, at info.accepted.com/118. We had a whole show actually devoted to the global insight requirement at Tuck. So if anybody's interested in that, they can learn more about it. But just to tie the two questions together, I mean, this is already hypothesizing or speculating, but is it possible that the close-knit nature of Tuck's community, because of its remote location, actually contributes to the tight ties of its alumni?
Oh, I think they're absolutely directly linked. I absolutely do. I mean, I think the bonds that are formed here and the supportive nature of the community, you know, the scale and the accessibility, the culture of personalization. One of the things I love about Tuck, having worked for three MBA programs, mm-hmm. is the sense of humility that I consistently find among our alumni. It's an incredibly supportive community and such a great place for a student to come and challenge themselves, knowing, you know, you can take some risks and get involved in an entrepreneurial project or write a business plan, try something completely new. It's a lot easier to do that within a really, really supportive community. I mean, I know this is going to sound a little absurd, but the phrase that I often use when I'm talking about Tuck alumni and the passion that they have for the school is that a lot of them talk about it with the same enthusiasm as like their firstborn child. I mean, it's really contagious. It really struck me when I came here because it's wonderful to be a part of. People just love this place. And I absolutely think that the experience that they have here on a personal level, as well as an academic level and a professional level, is directly linked to the enthusiasm that the alumni have.
There was a conference, I think it's almost 10 years ago now, at Tuck. This was, I think before you arrived there. But there was a couple of students, or I think just graduated students or maybe even a second year. And I remember there was one guy in particular, I think he was from France, and he said that he wanted to go to Tuck, and he got in, and he decided to go. But some of the enthusiasm he really felt was over the top. You know, when he heard students speak or alumni speak or the admission staff speak, and he says, well, I got here, he says, and all I can tell you is I've drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
I can still hear him saying it. I'm just as passionate. I'm completely over the top. This place is unbelievable.
Yeah, I can see where somebody who isn't as familiar with the community may be a little overwhelmed by that, but it is very genuine and so consistent among people. Yeah. And it's fun to be a part of a place that people are so positive about.
Absolutely.
You know, with any life experience, whether you're in a family or a group of friends or a club, you know, it's wonderful to be a part of a community that people are so positive and passionate about.
Right. Now, Tuck has, amidst all this continuity and all that, Tuck has a new dean, Dr. Matt Slaughter, who succeeds the widely admired and long-serving Dean Danos. What changes does he intend to bring to Tuck?
Matt just started in his new capacity at Tuck on July 1st, although, as you may know, he was an insider to Tuck, so he's been a very well-renowned international economist and professor at Dartmouth and Tuck for years. He has held many positions at Tuck that I think groomed him well to be the dean, but he's incredibly involved in multiple organizations in Washington, D.C. At one point, he was sort of on loan from talk under the Bush administration. He yeah. served on the Council for Economic Advisors. His list of the organizations that he consults with, the extent to which he testifies in Congress, his accomplishments are just too many to list. But I think, first of all, he's an incredibly inspiring leader, and he has so much internal support among the board, the students, the faculty, the staff. I think when and if he makes changes, he will be a great catalyst for change because he has the benefit of having this global perspective as a global economist, as well as preserving the elements of talk that make it so unique. But he has been working very hard at forming a new leadership team, and I know that they're excited to take talk to an even greater success level in the future. I think they're looking at, you know, how to refine the many strong programs that we offer, whether it's the full-time MBA program or various executive programs, and they're exploring, you know, reaching in new directions, both within the MBA space and in terms of just general business teaching that Tuck conducts as well. So it's a little too early to say exactly what changes he will bring, but I have all the confidence that whatever changes are determined will really make a lot of sense and will be of, you know, great benefit to Tuck. He's an really incredible person, probably one of the most kind people I've ever met, but very ambitious, very dynamic. He just addressed our first year students this weekend, and I've probably bumped into 20 people who said, wow, that was really inspiring. So we're really, really fortunate and excited to have him.
That's great. What advice, okay, final words of wisdom do you have for MBA applicants applying to Tuck?
I would say that we work really hard at being accessible within Tuck admissions, and we are the first people that you would interact with before, you know, interacting with other offices. So I would encourage people to really take advantage of the multiple ways to connect with us. We talked about the fact that we have an open interview policy. We do have visitation days. They're typically in the summer for people who are thinking about this on a more long-term basis. Mm-hmm. There's a brand new website that has lots of information about Tuck in general, as well as the admissions process. We hosted over 234 off-campus events last year, so please check out the website to see if there are any off-campus events in your area. The website would also list, you know, webinars and live chats that we offer. There is a feature called Tuck Connections that enables prospective students to connect with a Tuck alum by geography or area of interest. We have an upcoming Women in Business Conference, October 16th through 17th. We have an upcoming Diversity Conference, November 6th through 7th. Students do actually have to apply to participate in those conferences. So I would, say take advantage of one of a multitude of ways to connect with us, whether it's through, you know, a webinar or through Tuck Connections or actually coming for an interview.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today, Donna. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about Tuck's MBA program?
I will send you all the, you know, Twitter accounts and URLs so you can list them on the podcast if you'd like. We've got very active, in addition to the Tuck website, we have a very active, you know, a Facebook, Twitter, various social media opportunities to learn more about Tuck as well. So I'll send them all to you.
Great. Thank you. I'll include links in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/118. That's 118, to the sites Donna just mentioned, as well as to related articles. And with that, I want to thank you very much for coming. Listener, thank you too for joining Donna Clark and me for our 118th episode. If you find this show worthwhile, I have a favor to ask. Please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so helps us spread the news about Admission Straight Talk, especially if you leave those 5 shiny star ones. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave that review. And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.exhibit.com/118 or by sending an email to questions@exhibit.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.